From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, pro-choice advocates push the governor to help the Women's Reproductive Health Act become law. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on campaign finance reform, and some National Grid customers are not happy about a warm winter surcharge. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Pro-choice advocates promoting the Women's Reproductive Health Act say they are counting on Governor Andrew Cuomo to help the bill become law this year. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
The Reproductive Health Act, first introduced by former Governor Eliot Spitzer, would set in state law the right to accept or refuse contraception and the right to have a late-term abortion if a doctor determines that the health of the mother is at risk. It was originally proposed as a cleanup and expansion of New York's first-in-the-nation 1970 law legalizing abortion, and supporters say it would guarantee a number of reproductive rights for women in New York should the U.S. Supreme Court ever overturn Roe v. Wade. NARAL's Andrea Miller told a crowd of mostly women lobbyists that with the national debate once again raging over women's access to contraception, and including in Arizona a proposed law that would declare that life begins at ovulation, she says it's important that state leaders pass the act this year.
New York needs to send a powerful message that at least one state is willing and able to stand strong and stand up for women's health and rights.
Governor Cuomo reaffirmed his support for the Reproductive Health Act in his State of the State message back in January. But when he was asked about the issue on a radio show hosted by the New York Post's Fred Dicker, Cuomo hesitated, saying he didn't know if he'd taken a public position on the bill. The governor spoke just before a meeting with New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan, an opponent of the bill. Later, Cuomo clarified his stance in an interview with Public Radio.
I support the Reproductive Health Act. I supported it in my State of the State, and I fully support it. And I've been a long supporter of pro-choice initiatives going way, way back, and I always will be.
Cuomo says he disagrees with Cardinal Dolan about pro-choice issues, but tries to focus on what the two have in common instead. Cardinal Dolan, speaking after his meeting with Cuomo in mid-March, says he told the governor that he was worried about the Reproductive Health Act.
We feel a high responsibility to speak up for the baby in the womb. And whenever we see the abortion license being strengthened or consolidated or expanded, we get more and more worried. We're particularly worried about this one for a number of reasons. For one, it seems to be predicated upon almost a paranoia that abortion rights the abortion license is being restrained or set back, and we kind of wish it were, and it's not. If anything, we keep seeing it being expanded.
The governor was in Albany Tuesday but did not address the pro-choice groups. He did send a deputy secretary of civil rights, Alfonso David, to speak instead. David thanked the group for their hard work and enthusiasm.
And so is our hope that as we proceed that we will actually see it come to fruition.
NARAL's Miller says she takes the governor at his word.
There's no question in our mind that the governor supports this act. He certainly campaigned on it. It's been in his State of the State several times at this point. You know, I think he's very committed and has always been committed to women's reproductive health and rights. And it's really incumbent upon us, which is why we're up here with hundreds of people for the NARAL Pro-Choice New York Lobby Day, to demonstrate just how powerful the support in New York is, with three-quarters of New Yorkers supporting it, including 70% of Catholics. We see this as sort of the moment for this to move forward.
Neither Miller nor any of the other pro-choice lobbyists had meetings scheduled scheduled with Cuomo, though she says she hopes to get one soon. And she also hopes the governor will lend his political capital to the issue.
The governor needs to take this seriously and take leadership, and we need him on this.
In the meantime, the groups hope to convince some Republicans who are in the majority in the state Senate to agree to vote for the bill. The Democratic-dominated assembly likely has the votes for the Reproductive Health Act to pass. Miller says some GOP senators have told her privately that they would support the bill, but do not want to come out publicly until they're assured that a majority of the senators would vote yes. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, our political observer, Dr. Alan Chartok. And Alan, of course, this week launched a campaign finance reform campaign, and it has some heavy hitters in it. And we're seeing now some reaction from folks in the legislature. Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver says he would back a measure that would publicly finance only the state comptroller's race as a test case for a broader statewide system. And Governor Cuomo may introduce his own proposal that would overhaul campaign finance laws in the state. With this heavy hitters group, do you think they'll be able to push this into some sort of action?
No. So that's a short answer. The longer answer is this. Obviously, the comptroller's race bears some watching. We know that Alan Hevesy and the people who helped send him to jail, they had a pay-to-play arrangement. Now, this was not, we'll give you campaign contributions. This was, we'll give you money. And that turns out to have been a total disaster. So the very good comptroller of New York State, Tom DiNapoli, who, by the way, I should point out, was first elected to that position by the assembly, because the Democratic assembly, the Senate votes, but they have fewer votes. And really, because we know how it works, Sheldon Silver, because he's the head guy. Now, Tom DiNapoli has proved to be a wonderful comptroller, but he can't take any money to run for office. So the powers that don't like him, and among them we think is Andrew Cuomo, the powers that don't like him will find another candidate, I suspect, and that candidate will be well-funded. The comptroller can't really take any money because he knows what appearances are, and he won't do it. Silver is brilliant to say, let's start with the comptroller's office because it will help his friend Tom DiNapoli. Really a brilliant move. And also, it's very unlikely to just go to one person. Now, along come these very rich people, many of whom are very rich. Some of the top guys, like David Rockefeller, brother of Nelson. And they put up all this money and they say, we're going to try to get campaign financing done in New York State, just like it is in New York City. Well, New York City, you see, the way it happened is they have regular plebiscites. You can put it on the ballot. So the people overwhelmingly voted for it, and they got it in New York City. You have to raise some money, then it gets matched by the government or tax funds. Now, in New York State, the legislature decides. Shelley Silver may say, okay, maybe we'll go along with such a thing, because the Democrats generally don't have the kind of money that the Republicans have. But what will happen is that the New York State Senate, which is now controlled by like one or two votes by the Republicans, they're going to hate this because, you know, we all know that Republicans tend to, you know, represent business interests and other things and will get the money. So in the end, let me just say that it's not going to happen.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. National Grid natural gas customers have noticed a surcharge on their bills this quarter, and many are not happy to see the adjustment is due to the warm winter. We get more on that story from the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley.
National Grid has been able to add a weather normalization adjustment, or WNA, to a homeowner's bill since 1994. The WNA is included during the winter gas heating season to stabilize the cost of delivering gas and reduce wide fluctuations on utility bills, according to National Grid spokesperson Virginia Limiotis.
The weather normalization adjustment is included on the bills of gas heating customers between November 1st and March 1st. So when the weather is actually colder or warmer than the normal weather cycle based on a 30-year weather history of the area. The adjustment for normal weather in that line item comes on the bill in the form of a charge. When the weather is warmer than that normal 30-year average, that line item comes in the form of a refund when the weather is colder than the normal 30-year average. And so the premise behind the weather normalization adjustment is that it benefits our customers by helping to stabilize their bills.
Temperatures in January were higher than the 30-year average, so Limiotis says National Grid's residential natural gas customers saw an average $1.70 charge. But she adds that last year, their customers received a credit, averaging 39 cents due to colder temperatures. The WNA surcharge is part of rate negotiations with the Public Service Board and is perfectly legal, according to board spokesman James Den.
There are set costs to operate a utility, to pay for the transmission and distribution lines. The commission works very hard to ensure that the utility earns no more or no less than it needs to operate the system. Delivery rates are set based on expected gas delivery volumes for normal weather conditions. If the weather is extremely warm, the need for natural gas for heating purposes would be significantly reduced, and the utility wouldn't be able to collect enough revenues to cover costs. If the weather is extremely cold, the need for gas would be much higher, and the utility would collect more revenues than they needed to cover costs. So what regulators seek to do is balance this equation.
National Grid is not the only utility to use the weather normalization adjustment. The WNA appears on utility gas bills across the country. The Public Utility Law Project, or PULP, is a utility watchdog. Executive Director Gerald Norlander says the natural gas surcharge is common.
The way the regulators have been looking at gas companies is they've been trying to make them just a pipes company and just pass through the prices in the wholesale gas markets without trying to hedge those. And the delivery revenue that they need is going to be the same no matter how much they deliver. And so they need to get a return on their investment. They need to get recovery for the cost of operations and so forth. It is often a surprise to customers when they think they will get all the benefit of a warm winter. They're probably getting some benefit of the warm winter, and they certainly are getting great benefit from the lower prices this year.
According to the New York Public Service Commission, which regulates natural gas delivery rates, there are about 3.9 million natural gas heating customers across the state serviced by various utilities.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
A report released this week shows that 1.5 million New Yorkers could experience gaps in health insurance coverage due to fluctuations in their incomes and eligibility for certain programs and subsidies. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas has more.
The Coalition of New York State Public Health Plans report finds that 30% of non-elderly New Yorkers below 400% of the federal poverty level, that's $76,360 of annual income for a family of three, will experience year-to-year income fluctuations that potentially affect their eligibility for public coverage programs like Medicaid or for subsidized coverage through the coming health insurance exchange. Patricia Buzang co-authored the report.
The report is really about a key aspect of designing an exchange that works, and that is making sure that as people's income changes, particularly low-income people who are eligible for Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program and the new federal tax credits that are going to be available through exchanges, that we have strategies in place to make sure that they're able to retain the subsidies they need to access affordable health insurance coverage.
Buzang notes that income fluctuation varies substantially by income level. Those with incomes that hover just above the Medicaid eligibility cutoff experience the greatest degree of fluctuation, therefore the greatest risk of interruptions in coverage. Families that live within 130% and 185% of the federal poverty level of $19,090 for a family of three are most vulnerable to recurrent ups and downs in their income. Again, Patricia Buzang.
The 133% really speaks to what will be the new national income threshold for Medicaid eligibility, so that families with family incomes up to 133% of the federal poverty level will be eligible for Medicaid. And then families above that income level will be eligible for federal tax credits to purchase health insurance coverage through the new exchange.
Elizabeth Benjamin is Vice President of Health Initiatives at the Community Service Society of New York and co-founder of Healthcare for All New York.
Because health reform builds on a patchwork of programs, we want to align, you know, work-based, job-based coverage, exchange-based coverage, public coverage, and people have went transfer between these different forms of coverage, public coverage, job-based coverage, and exchange-based coverage. And we want these transition points to be smooth. And what this report so importantly identifies is that there are all these little transition points, and 1.5 million people in any given year might be affected by these transition points. And so the exchange has to be designed in a way that those transitions are smooth and seamless, that no one encounters any turbulence as they move from program to program.
Benjamin expects individual and family costs of health insurance under the exchange will go down by 66%, and small business costs will come down by 22%. There's a link to the full paper entitled Achieving Continuity of Insurance Coverage for Lower-Income New Yorkers in 2014 on our website, wamc.org. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This month marks the one-year anniversary of the New York State law that requires that all those old computers, TVs, and cell phones you have lying around the house be recycled instead of simply thrown in the trash. Under the law, manufacturers have to collect and recycle the products they create when consumers are done with them. But a new report by the Natural Resources Defense Council finds the law is having mixed results. Reporter Tracy Samuelson of New York Public Radio followed one discarded computer through the recycling process.
It's an old gray Gateway computer tower, Pentium 4, Windows XP, recently put out to pasture by the New School in Chelsea. The school has gathered over 750 pounds of electronic waste, or e-waste, for recycling over the last 2 weeks, and they've hired a company called Fourth Bin to collect it.
So four big hulking computers weighing in at 129 pounds.
John Kirsch is one of the company's co-founders. He picks up e-waste for recycling in a rented U-Haul and, depending on size, charges between $10 and $125 per item.
I mean, you can tell how old they are. The Gateway's been out of business for 5 years now.
The average U.S. household now has 24 electronic devices. And as we rush to replace them with the latest, greatest model, we're literally creating tons of e-waste. 2.4 million tons each year.
52 pounds.
And only a quarter of that is recycled. When it's not, there's the risk that toxins inside, lead, mercury, beryllium, can end up polluting the groundwater or the air. The end of the gateway starts with a truck ride to Fourth Bin's storage facility in Harlem, then on to the warehouse of a company called We Recycle outside the city. There, it joins a graveyard of TVs, printers, faxes, phones, miles of tangled cables and cords. First stop, the harvest department, where disassembly technician Robert Marcial starts tearing it apart.
Now, inside, it's main contents that we try to take off first. It's the aluminum, battery, the hard drives, and also the CPUs. You can see, like, some of the platinum actually shining and glistening.
When he's done, the computer is just a sad shell. Supervisor Carlos Jorge knows it's the end of the line for our gateway.
That's where it gets cut. That's our twin shaft shredder. It'll break it in half to three-quarter pieces. Ready?
From here, the chewed up pieces are sorted into bags of metals, plastics, and circuit boards. Each will be sold to another recycler, who will melt them down and make new gadgets and devices. The whole cycle will start again.
Break time.
Between the new school and the shredder, at least 10 people touched our gateway computer over 20 miles on three trucks through three warehouses. Sounds like a lot, but it's actually not, says Kate Sinding, a lawyer with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
It's much more likely that something gets collected and then goes either a significant distance within state or possibly out of state, or in many cases, abroad for handling.
Congress is considering legislation to ban shipping e-waste abroad, where it could be dumped, incinerated, or dismantled using child labor. And about half of all states have passed their own e-waste laws. In New York, starting this year, companies can no longer dump their old equipment in the trash. In 2015, the same will apply to consumers. Like most states, New York makes e-waste recycling the manufacturer's job. They have to collect a certain amount each year or face fines. But consumers still have to get their dead electronics to the manufacturer.
In New York City, where rates of car ownership are much lower, where there are fewer clear options for permanent collection facilities, you know, we don't have a dump in that sense, it's not been as successful.
Manufacturers are collecting most of their required tonnage upstate. Christine Dotz Romero organizes one-day collection events around the city. She also recently opened a warehouse in Brooklyn where people can come and drop off their e-waste.
It'll take a lot of these sort of projects to really cover all of New York City. But in the end, that's what we need to create. We need to really create an infrastructure.
Infrastructure like more warehouses, pop-up collection events, and education. So people will know that this stuff can't go in the trash and what options they have for getting rid of it.
That was New York Public Radio's Tracy Samuelson. Support for the Innovation Trail comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Innovation Trail is a collaboration between five upstate public media outlets reporting about New York's innovation economy. You can hear more at innovationtrail.org. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of the program are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1216. Or just listen or podcast on the web, wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.